What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Well, look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Say, she's quite a character, that Norma Desmond.
She was the greatest. You wouldn't know. You're too young.
In 1 week, she received 17,000 fan letters. Men bribed the hairdresser to get a lock of her hair. There was a Maharaja who came all the way from India to beg one of her silk stockings. Later, he strangled himself with it.
Well, I sure turned into an interesting driveway.
Unlike William Holden's Joe Gillis, we won't be turning into Norma Desmond's driveway on Sunset Boulevard for this week's Top 5 Movies About Fame, Non-Hollywood Edition.
So there are famous people outside of Hollywood?
We'll see if we can come up with five anyway.
Adam and I are joined this week by one of those famous outsiders, our friend Michael Phillips from the Chicago Tribune. Along with the Top 5, we'll share some thoughts on the new Roger Ebert documentary Life Itself and last weekend's tragic passing of actor Philip Seymour Hoffman as a precursor to a more substantial tribute next week. That and more ahead on Film Spotting. This episode of Film Spotting is brought to you by Shutterstock.com. With over a million high-quality video clips, Shutterstock helps you take your creative projects to the next level. For 25% off your new account, go to Shutterstock.com and use offer code FILM214.
We're also brought to you this week by Warby Parker. And Josh, I have to ask you, I've never seen you wear glasses. Are you one of those people just blessed with perfect vision?
20/20. That's why I'm always right about the movies, Adam.
Exactly. You just see it so much more.
Yep.
Clearer than the rest of us. Well, I don't wear glasses all that often either. I'm a little bit nearsighted, so you may see me when I'm driving or, of course, looking at something that's far away for a while. Maybe I'm at a sporting event. I will tend to wear glasses. And I've never thought to really wear glasses more than I absolutely had to because, well, my frames aren't that fashionable. And I've never even had a backup pair basically because frames are just really expensive. But that all may change thanks to Warby Parker. They offer prescription lenses starting at $95. These are boutique style and quality glasses. And the cool thing is you get to try them on at home. You can order 5 pairs of glasses, have them shipped to you for free, try them on at home, get to check them out, post pictures of you, have your friends and family weigh in,
Debbie
or your wife.
Debbie is going to love this.
Yeah.
This is how she shops for shoes.
It's fantastic. And I did this. I ordered my home try-on set. I've got 5 pairs of really cool glasses coming. And who knows, maybe if they do work out, Josh, you'll end up seeing me in here with my stylish lenses. I'll have some for every day of the week, some stylish eyeglasses. The other thing I really enjoy about this company is what they do to give a little back is every time they sell a pair of eyeglasses, they donate a pair of eyeglasses to someone in need. So they'll partner with a nonprofit like Vision Spring to give glasses to people who need them. And all their glasses include anti-reflective and anti-glare coating, a hard case, and a cleaning cloth. So if you want to try Warby Parker's stylish glasses out for free, you can do that easily. Again, I mentioned the home try-on program. Just go to warbyparker.com/filmspotting. Choose your 5 pairs of glasses, and they'll send them to you so you can try on. And if you like them, you can obviously keep some of them or send back the ones that don't work for you. They include a special frame box and a prepaid shipping label for easy return. And again, you can try them on. My wife can tell me how good or bad I look and make the decision from there. All you do, choose the frames you want, enter your prescription details if you need one, of course, and Warby Parker takes care of the rest.
If you want to give Warby Parker a try for those stylish new pair of prescription glasses or sunglasses, just go to warbyparker.com/filmspotting. Be sure to check out the free home try-on. When you do decide to purchase, you can get 3-day free shipping through warbyparker.com/filmspotting. That's warbyparker.com/filmspotting. We thank Warby Parker for their support.
You're listening to Film Spotting. The only appropriate thing to do, surely, would be to devote an entire episode to the untimely passing of actor Philip Seymour Hoffman. I know we have thought of little else here since we heard the news on Sunday afternoon. Hoffman was 46 and the father of 3, and I think safe to say one of the greatest actors of this generation, maybe of any generation, and we will devote an entire episode to him next week. We'll share our and hopefully some of your top five Philip Seymour Hoffman scenes. You can send your emails now if you want to get a jump on that, feedback@filmspotting.net, or leave us a voicemail, 312-264-0744. This week, we'll proceed as scheduled with our top five movies about fame. That's later in the show. But first, we want to welcome in our friend from the Chicago Tribune, here for his monthly visit, Michael Phillips. It's great to have you here, Michael.
Welcome,
hello, Michael.
Hello, man.
It's interesting that we're going to talk about this Roger Ebert documentary, Life Itself, directed by Steve James, because Monday night, there was a screening of Life Itself with the director and a few others, including Roger's wife, Chaz Ebert, at the Paley Center in New York, obviously following on the heels of the tragic news of Philip Seymour Hoffman's passing. And Chaz said at the Q&A after that Roger always confided that if an actor was ever to play him on the screen, he always wanted Philip Seymour Hoffman to play him in a movie. He always said that he was one of the best, most versatile actors ever, and we certainly agree with that. Sadly, we won't ever get to see Hoffman's take on Roger Ebert, but we can see the man himself in Life Itself.
We all are born with a certain package. We are who we are. Where we were born, who we were born as, how we were raised. We're kind of stuck inside that person. And the purpose of civilization and growth is to be able to reach out and empathize a little bit with other people. And for me, the movies are like a machine that generates empathy. It lets you understand a little bit more about different hopes, aspirations, dreams, and fears. It helps us to identify with the people who are sharing this journey with us.
People first got a chance to see Life Itself, the Steve James documentary on Roger Ebert's life, at the Sundance Film Festival. And as you can expect, nothing but a positive response to it. A gathering like that is made for a film like that, which was as much about Ebert's life and work as it was about the act of criticism, the act of watching movies and how we receive them and process them and talk about them together. When I saw it, that was one of the things that stood out, is the way Ebert, throughout his career, well before the advent of social media, developed this idea of going to the movies as a community. He had a community of readers, a community of people he would gather with, whether it was at the bars he would frequent at the beginning of his career, and just really live those discussions out for movie lovers. There came to be some pushback to that approach, though, and the documentary, especially interesting to me, is how it made space for this when Ebert and Gene Siskel began their show and popularized this approach to movie criticism for people who weren't academics or weren't trained critics or professional critics, and their show brought movie criticism to the masses. And one of the pushbacks to their show came from Times film critic Richard Corliss, who in 1990 wrote a piece for Film Comment, I believe it was called All Thumbs, and his position was that the approach they took on the show was reductive in a bad way of how we did engage with movies. By a thumbs up or a thumbs down really didn't allow for the sort of deep engagement that he felt the movies deserved from critics and from anyone really who was going to see them and engage them. So I was curious while watching it, Michael, and I'm really glad we have you on the show to kind of help us think through this, because you faced some of those challenges when you were reviewing films on TV as well. How do we, in this medium, how do we do that in a way that honors the work itself? Even on a podcast like Film Spotting, we're limited in the radio version, but the podcast version, we can go on and on, as we often do, and give the films as much space as we feel they deserve. But maybe you can speak to that sort of particular challenge, because my experience was being appreciative as a kid who grew up on that show,
right,
for the exposure I got, even if it was in that little dollop, a minute and a half, 2 minutes, whatever they were able to give.
Right.
I treasured those 2 minutes. I was not in a position at that point to buy or read Film Comment every month. But I could sit down in front of my TV with my family and watch their show on Saturday night and learn about these films.
Right.
So
yeah,
I don't know. Can you maybe we'll start there just a little bit with your experience of trying to do criticism in that sort of venue?
It's a completely different mission, and you just have to kind of throw away one set of ambitions for it and try to master a couple of other ones that are all about concision, figuring out the one or two things you feel you must say about that movie, whatever you thought about it. You know, on the show with Siskel, Roger was able to, in the heyday, stretch out on the movies that they cared about. And by the time I stepped in for Roger when he got sick in 2006, opposite Richard Roper, and then I was alternating with A.O. Scott for a while, and then Tony and I took it over for the final season. By then, we were dealing with a very rigidly prescribed formula of a very short back and forth and several different segments. And, you know, honestly, the thing that Tony and I were proudest of in the year we had it was that we were able to kind of bust that formula up a little bit. And if, say, a new Scorsese film opens up that week, whatever we thought of it, and in that case we both didn't like Shutter Island very much, but it was a good excuse to just devote most of the rest of the show to talking about Scorsese films we did like. So it's basically like it was a film spotting format, you know? And that was great because there was a lot of all this, you know, worrying and skepticism about, oh, well, are they going to – and we got great feedback on that because I think people were, by that point, a little sick of the formula. And it was Roger's great gift. And you see this in life itself, that he really could intelligently communicate short form and long form. And that's really the way to look at it. You know, maybe it's for the same reason, Josh, I don't mind Twitter. I mean, I know the kids are already turning their backs on it, but to me, it's a wonderful exercise in pith. And, you know, whether it's 140 characters there or 2 minutes there or, you know, this bizarre circumstance I've done a dozen times or so over the years, you know, you get flown out to New York by CBS Saturday morning. You do 2.5 minutes opposite Dana Stevens or Tony Scott or some other New Yorker just talking about some movie or some issue. And it's literally you're flown out, put up, do the 2 minutes and come back. And that's insane. You know, it's because all you're thinking the whole time is like, but I needed to say this. And the first few times I was on the show with Richard Roper, I just didn't know what hit me. I thought, well, you know, because you're so used to kind of like clearing your throat in print or in some sort of discussion, and you just can't do that. You got to find the one thing you got
to
say.
And you're right about Ebert being able to transition to all those different forms, with which Life itself documents. It does a good job of showing how he went from a newspaperman to all the way through using blogs and Twitter itself. Mm-hmm. I mean, he was brilliant on Twitter. And to be able to change that message but still have that same level of movie love and insight he would bring to whatever medium he was working in was really astonishing.
Of course, it's somewhat difficult to talk about a documentary like Life itself, especially in your case, Michael, as you said, you not only filled in for the man, but knew the man. And I never had a chance actually to meet Roger Ebert, so I can't speak to that. But what did you hope to get out of a documentary like Life itself, which is based on the memoir, which you are familiar with and
right.
have read? And did you get it?
Did I get it? I was afraid, Adam, going into it, that Life itself would just, frankly, be kind of a provincial, promotional, hometown effort. As good as Steve James is, and I'm a big fan of Hoop Dreams and The Interrupters especially, I worried that because Steve James has acknowledged this, that Roger was instrumental in getting James's career sort of into a wider arena of praise and acceptance with the Hoop Dreams review and support all through the years. And so James is not, God knows he's not in any kind of, you know, objective arena for that. I don't want an objective filmmaker, even if it's a documentarian, to address any subject, because I think the good work comes from informed subjectivity, not objectivity. So I was worried about the promotional aspect. It didn't really happen. I think it's a fairly tough-minded film, and there's a lot of, you know, the difficult material in Life itself is all in the access that James had in the rehab hospital mm-hmm. that, where unfortunately Roger and Chaz spent an awful lot of their last, you know, Roger's last few months in. And some of that footage is very difficult to watch. And yet, I think James' innate taste, kind of self-effacing skill as a filmmaker really kept that rougher, more painful material from seeming exploitive or or cheap. I didn't get that feeling, and I think I would have if it was there, because you just, although I know some people, I had Rick Hogan on the, you know, a Trip video the other week, and he just said I couldn't watch it, could not watch it. And I mean, he
and
knew
he's
Roger,
in it.
He knew he was in it all, he's in it up and down, and he knew Roger decades longer than I did.
Well, it's tough to watch. I mean, but in a good way, in an honest way. And I think Ebert, when he became ill, was very honest about not hiding that at all. And he speaks in the film a little bit about that, his experience with Siskel passing informed that a little bit, how his approach was going to be when he found out he was sick, and whether it was continuing to go to screenings when he was largely in a wheelchair. He never hid what he was struggling with, and this documentary is really a continuation of that. It's a portrait of vulnerability beyond everything it has to do with film criticism, and the way that comes through is discomforting in a way that I think it should be.
You know, it's a good point, and the film, they got it down to less than 2 hours. It's not a documentary about Roger's ultimate place in modern film criticism. It's really not concerned with that. You get a little bit of discussion of approach and aesthetics with Corliss and with Jonathan Rosenbaum, a very different and brilliant Chicago-based critic who had quibbles similar to Corliss's originally, just that the show was middle brow and kind of dumbed down the whole film discussion, even as it popularized it. That's the paradox. But it's not that kind of film. I mean, it is not a completist film. It's not, there's no mention of Richard Roper at all, which is a little, if you're really talking about the timeline, is a little odd, I suppose. But so be it. I don't, the film does well. I mean, the only thing I honestly thought it came up short on is that when it deals a fair bit with Roger's childhood, and we're getting excerpts from the autobiography that talks about that childhood, you don't really get much of the real, sort of the odder, more painful colors of that.
True.
Because he had a happy childhood, he said, in most ways, but you know, kind of a tricky set of parents and alcoholism, and though the film itself does not shy away from the alcoholism angle at all, I think some of that childhood stuff seems rosy to a fault.
You're listening to Film Spotting. We're here with Chicago Tribune film critic Michael Phillips discussing the new documentary from Steve James, Life Itself. It's based on the memoir from Roger Ebert. It is a film that is playing in select theaters now and will have a little bit more of a wider release coming later. It premiered here recently at the Sundance Film Festival out there in Park City, Utah. And it's a film, for me, I'm glad that you mentioned timeline, Michael, because that was my biggest concern, is I felt like going in, it was perhaps just going to be a film that kind of chronologically told this story and hit all the notes it needed to hit, which I don't know why I thought that, because I have a lot of faith in Steve James as a documentarian, but maybe it's just a matter of Ebert having such a full life and there being so many accolades and so much to cover that I wouldn't begrudge him if he sort of hit all those notes along the way, but he really doesn't. He darts around in time a little bit. He follows certain themes where they go. And what did surprise me as well, Josh, is how much time it's spent on the time in the hospital and his recovery. And it really becomes much more a portrait of his battle with mortality and how he dealt with that, and his endless optimism, and also really what comes through. And we all know this about Ebert from reading his stuff or watching his show, but just that boundless capacity for love, just that passion that he had for the newspaper business, for film, for Chicago, for Chaz, and it goes on and on, for discovering new filmmakers and new talents. That really comes through here, and I give credit to Steve James for that, and also that determination in the face of despair. What he showed in those scenes in a way that I don't know that many of us would have the fortitude to really handle.
Right.
And it comes through.
I'd say the archival details I really appreciated and had heard about, but hadn't really heard about in this kind of detail, were the pieces that Roger wrote for the Daily Illini when he was, before he was 20, but he was going to school at University of Illinois, Champaign-Urbana, right? And the piece he wrote when JFK got shot, there was a civil rights editorial after one of the church bombings, I believe, in Alabama. And the excerpts you hear from that are just like, wow, that guy really, right away, you know. And the other thing I really appreciated was, I think there's been a lot of hooey, frankly, built up around the Siskel-Ebert partnership in that, oh, yeah, they fought, but they really loved each other. end of story. It's really just a question of a flip of the coin, which foot you land on that one.
Yeah.
Because what you get here is a very complicated, incredibly, fiercely competitive relationship and friendship that happened also to be a business relationship that benefited them both to the tune of millions of dollars.
Right.
So, but I love the detail where Gene finds out that Roger's engaged to Chaz, and he's going to, you know, he's going to kind of leave the bachelor days behind and settle down, not be tempted by any potential offers outside of Chicago. But he said, and the fact that Gene just felt nothing but relief. It's like, we got this. He's not leaving town. I'm okay for a while. You know, yeah. And it's good. It's a natural human part of their very intensely jealous, kind of competitive and yes, loving relationship they had. Mm-hmm.
I think I did come away with a lot more respect for Siskel as a critic after seeing this film, because I trying to remember when I started reading reviews, I think he had been moved a little bit to the sidebar in the Tribune. I think Dave Kerr had become the main critic at that time. So Siskel was given, and it's funny in this talk about how do you communicate in different mediums? He was given maybe 50 words or something like that to review a film, in addition to the show, of course. And so it always seemed like a lesser effort compared to Ebert's pieces in the Sun Times.
Right.
But here you get a better sense of Siskel's background, where he was coming from, the level of education he had, and what he was bringing to his reviews, and just that ability to give the back and forth with Ebert that he did on the show to make it an equal pairing in a lot of ways.
Now, the arcane trivia on this, if that's not redundant, is that when Gene and Roger left the Tribune company with the show and to go over to Disney, they were angry. The Tribune was angry, so they canned him. They canned Siskel and hired Dave to be the film critic. And then apparently, and I can be corrected if somebody has better information than this, Gene started talking to the Sun-Times about, hey, let's take the double act over to the Sun-Times and we'll both be in print. Oh, sounds pretty good. Tribune gets wind of that and, let's hire Gene back to do this sideline job that seems weirdly competitive with our own film critic, Dave.
Uh-huh.
But so be it. So that's why you had that bizarre situation of Gene sort of in the paper but sideline.
It was weird.
Yeah, but it was a paycheck.
I agree with you, though, Michael, that relationship comes off very nuanced here, because I think it can be reduced to that. And Roger often would use that phrase about how deep the love was despite how meaningless the fights were and all that. But I think that there are new details here to that relationship, despite all the things I've seen and all that I've read about it, that come through here, even just what is explained by Siskel's wife. And you get some insights into the way Gene felt about Roger that I thought made the film, just that alone, was rewarding. And I think that relationship is another one that you could fill multiple documentaries with, probably just focusing on that. But I think Steve James did a commendable job here getting in just enough insight and nuance that we needed to make it feel substantial to this film. And I think, to get personal for a second, one of the things that really did emerge for me watching this movie and seeing how that relationship was dealt with was it made me consider how fortunate I am to have been able to do this show for the past 9 years, over 9 years now, and have partners, multiple people, and be able to sit across from you, Michael, and have these types of discussions and have those kind of relationships that are unique. You know, they're business relationships, like you said, in some way, but something about having to sit across from someone every week. And it's not just a business partnership. It's more than that, because you're exposing something so much more personal. I mean, that's what cinema really is, right? It's all about your passion and whatever perspective you're bringing to it. And that is something I got from the film, is it made me really appreciate what I've been able to do here and some of those relationships I've been able to forge over the years.
I haven't really gotten much out of these appearances.
I'm sure not.
I appreciate this.
It's meant a lot to me. It's really meant a lot to me. And I think that the vulnerability, I think, Josh, you used that word, that's what really comes through with Ebert here a lot, because as much as he could be blustery and bossy and seemed like he was always in charge, that vulnerability was always what I sensed watching the show. And it certainly comes through in his most personal reviews.
And the movie documents the rewards of offering that vulnerability up. I think you see it in the family that surrounds him and just the support and the love that they gave to him throughout everything that he did face at the end there. And it shows in the response he got from readers. I mean, the relationships he built with readers were unique in terms of how people interact with critics.
And so many people, all kinds of different critics, had popped that guy a letter. Dana Stevens wrote him when she was 11 or 12 or something, like, hey, I'd like to be a critic. And, you know, just write a very gracious, helpful letter back. And it just makes you realize that every little kindness like that, if you take the minute to do it, can pay off. And that's... this town, guys, Chicago is full of newspaper lore about people who essentially work themselves to death and become heroes. And Roger worked like a maniac. He really worked like a dog, and was the biggest guy in his field in the country as a result. But none of that would have meant anything if he really didn't have something to say, and he didn't have a deceptively easygoing style in which to say it. And that's what you really have to look to. That's why people read the collected editions of the reviews, because it's in his personal sort of prose style. There's a lot to be learned both about movies and about writing.
Yeah. I think it's funny, too, because we're talking about our top five movies about fame. And as I was thinking about the main characters I was focusing on for the movies that ultimately made my list, how they stood in such stark contrast to someone as famous as Roger Ebert. What drove these characters? Because whatever ego he had, and certainly no one really debates that he did, you sort of have to if you're going to put yourself out there in that way. What comes through in this film is that everything was driven by his natural curiosity, mm-hmm. his empathy, the intellectual pursuit of film criticism, and his desire to connect with other people. And I think you do see that in how he continued on despite those health issues, when, as I said, most of us, I think, would throw in the towel, he still had that need to connect. And there's even that great scene where we see him looking at the revamped version of his website, the version see now. And you think about why that would be important to him at this point, when who knows how much time he's got left, how much pride he takes, and how giddy he got looking at his new website. And you realize that it's not so much about trying to leave a legacy in a narcissistic way to prove to the world that I mattered, look what I accomplished, but to just keep that conversation going. Right?
Well, look at one of the key features of the new website are these far-flung correspondents.
Right.
So critics from around the world that he has found and appreciated their viewpoint and given them this platform, this forum. Yeah.
To keep that dialogue going. I mean, that's really the Roger Ebert legacy. Life itself is slowly rolling out to theaters with dates scheduled in Athens, Georgia, Sioux Falls, South Dakota, Chicago, and L.A. this month. More information at kartemquin.com. If you've seen the movie or just have any thoughts about Roger you'd like to share with us, you can email us feedback@filmspotting.net. You can also leave us a voicemail, 312-264-0744, or find us on Twitter @filmspotting and facebook.com/filmspotting.
Adam and I get to gang up on Michael next in Massacre Theater. We apologize in advance, Michael. And who's going to live forever? Who's going to learn to fly? High? Certainly the actors and actresses who make our lists of the best movies about fame. The Film Spotting Top 5 begins next. Stay with us. 2:30 Eastern Time, I'm out the blue, out of the line. A stunning and complete loss of control. The tenor of the hour, a cruel and otherworldly power. I pray to someone's God to make me whole. Oh, my baby. Trigger of a tune, the killing joke, the killing moon, the killing of me softly with his song. 2:30 Eastern Time, out of the blue, out of the line, a gasp of breath and pity I had enough. Oh my baby, I'll remember you in hope, in peace, in love. She's gone. Gone, just like the wind, she's gone, and never to be found, never to be mine. She's gone. Quick interruption here, folks, to remind you that Film Spotting is brought to you by Warby Parker Eyewear. You can get boutique-quality, classically crafted eyewear at revolutionary prices. For a free home try-on of 5 stylish frames of your choice, go to warbyparker.com/filmspotting. When you decide to purchase, go to warbyparker.com/filmspotting, and you'll get free 3-day shipping.
We're also brought to you by Shutterstock.com. Tying in with this week's show, our discussion of the Roger Ebert documentary, Life Itself, I went to Shutterstock.com, Josh, and I did a search for Ebert 37 photographs came up. I also was thinking about The Great Beauty, the movie we're going to talk about a little bit in bonus content. Did a search for beauty. you get a lot more than just 37. 86,622 images that match the word beauty on Shutterstock. So you never know. Maybe you've got a project coming up, whether it's for your website, advertisement, multimedia presentation, or some other type of film project that you need an image that matches that description. They've got over 1 million high-quality stock video clips, 2D animations, and 3D motion graphics. I know we have very many graphic designers out there, many of them who already use Shutterstock or who could benefit from their services. They give you all the assets you need to bring your creative projects to the next level and make it really easy. You can use their tools to search and drill down by category, clip resolution, contributor name, and more. And they've got flexible pricing, so you can just get an individual clip or purchase a video pack. You can get clips in HD or save with standard definition or web formats.
You can try Shutterstock today by signing up for a free account. You don't need a credit card. Just start an account and begin using Shutterstock and save your video selections that you do find to your clip box. When you do decide to purchase, use offer code FILM214 and new accounts will receive 25% off any package. That's Shutterstock.com, and for 25% off new accounts, use offer code FILM214. We thank Shutterstock for their support.
I can give you $35. Give me 1,000 words on Black Sabbath.
An assignment?
Yeah. Yeah. Hey. You have to make your reputation on being honest and, unmerciful.
Honest. Unmerciful.
Yeah, if you get into a jam, you can call me. I stay up late.
Welcome back to Film Spotting with Josh Larson and Michael Phillips. I'm Adam Kempinar. That was the late Philip Seymour Hoffman as Lester Bangs, with Patrick Fugit's William Miller and Cameron Crowe's Almost Famous. Next week, we're going to devote the entire show to Hoffman's incredible and tragically short career. We'll share our top five Hoffman scenes. Our poll question this week has us considering Hoffman's best performances in the kind of roles we first encountered him. Small roles, sometimes single scene roles that, if played by another, maybe lesser actor, would almost certainly be forgotten. That's later. Right now, though, it's time for some acting that truly will be forgotten in good time: Massacre Theater.
We perform a scene, you get a chance at winning a prize. Last time, Adam and I massacred this scene.
Who is it?
It's Mikhail Blomqvist.
Actually, I'm not really off yet.
May I come in, please? Hi. You and I need to talk. I've got us some breakfast. I'm sorry, I didn't realize you had some company.
Hey, who do you think you are?
I'm the guy you know better than my closest friends do. Why don't you put some clothes on? Get rid of your girlfriend. We need to talk.
That was Daniel Craig as Mikhail Blomqvist, no, not Mikhail Baryshnikov, and Rooney Mara as Lisbeth Salander in David Fincher's 2011 remake of The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. The screenplay was by Steve Zalian.
Dave Richards, not too far away here in Berwyn, writes, I thought that this Massacre Theater was supposed to be difficult. Even through Josh's truly bizarre Daniel Craig impression, I could tell that was the initial scene where Mikhail Blomqvist and Lisbeth Salander meet in person for the first time from Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. I conjured up the following tie-ins. First, David Fincher directed this movie. In the last episode, the two of you spoke about anticipating upcoming directorial projects. I believe you both mentioned Fincher's Gone Girl. Second, Rooney Mara starred as Lisbeth Salander. And in this episode, Adam mentioned one of his most anticipated upcoming projects for 2014 is the movie Carol, starring Rooney Mara opposite Cate Blanchett. The third tie-in is probably the least likely, but my favorite. Mikhail Baryshnikov, that was the name we inserted there, and somehow Josh ended up going down that path with a Russian accent instead of Swedish.
I will say my accent is misguided, but it's better than Daniel Craig's in that scene.
Maybe
more
so.
More consistent.
A bold statement, but might be true. Baryshnikov played Sarah Jessica Parker's love interest in the last season of the show Sex and the City. By Josh picking the name Baryshnikov, not only does it fit the name Michael Blomqvist, but I believe it reveals that Josh secretly pines for a third installment of the Sex and the City movie franchise. He was probably left unsatisfied with the second movie and believes that the series needs a proper trilogy. Like I said before, probably the least likely, but one can hope.
I can't say I'm pining for a third, but I will confess that I like those two films.
Really?
Yes.
The second one?
Wow,
yes.
That's another one that should have been on the
Dave
application.
I don't know if Dave researched that, but Those weren't in Pantheon contention, huh?
No. Okay. They most certainly weren't.
Rally Miller from Columbus, Ohio said, for tie-ins, I've only got two obvious answers. Rooney Mara will give one of Adam's most anticipated performances of the year, and both Lisbeth Salander and Elise Vandeveld of Broken Circle Breakdown have large visible tattoos.
There you go. Tattoos was where we were going, along with Rooney Mara featuring prominently in my top five list last week. We discussed the Belgian film nominated for Best Foreign Language Film, Broken Circle Breakdown, and Elisa is a tattoo artist and features many prominent tattoos on her body. Finally, we heard from Ben Haworth in Austin, Texas, who says, I think you are all being too hard by saying that no one would get this film through Josh's rendition of Daniel Craig's already bad accent by channeling Clint Eastwood doing an impression of Yakov Smirnoff.
What a country.
What a country indeed, Josh. You should have used that line. But Marzi from Brooklyn, New York says, as a Russian expat, I found the accent, while totally random, quite cute.
Oh, well, thank you,
so,
Ben.
So there you go, a little support. If you want to hear that quite cute Russian accent, plus our top five most anticipated performances of the year and our review of Broken Circle Breakdown, you can find that show at filmspotting.net or via iTunes. Michael, very briefly, Broken Circle Breakdown, seen it? Yay or nay?
Haven't seen it.
You need to see it.
Do I?
Yeah, we're
we
seeing for sure.
Yeah.
We both liked it quite
okay,
a bit.
Okay, all right. Well, you know, I occasionally get some good advice from you guys.
Occasionally.
Okay.
Josh, why don't you reach into the film spotting hat and pick out this week's winner.
Our winner is Rick Maragi from Los Angeles.
Congratulations, Rick, and hearty congratulations are in order here. I believe that Rick has been entering Massacre Theater since fall of 2006.
Wow, that's persistence.
It's persistence, and it has finally paid off. Rick, email feedback at filmspotting.net to claim your film spotting t-shirt. It's all worth it. 6-7 years. It's all worth it.
Margaret just doesn't miss performances. If she can walk, crawl, or roll, she plays. The show must go on. No, dear. Margot must go on.
It's time now for this week's edition of Massacre Theater, a three-person scene appropriate for Michael's edition here. And we'll tell you, it ties in with our top five movies about fame. Not a film that had a chance at making any of our lists.
No.
Frankly.
Not even a film Michael, he just told us, has ever seen.
Right.
Never,
so
never seen it.
I don't know how he's actually going to perform this. I mean, he's going to have to act. He's just going to have to bring his own thing to it. He's going to go method.
I'm going to go method free.
I love it. Yep. You're going to start it off. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
I'm going to give you the action.
Okay.
And action.
I thought I told you to turn off your phone.
Turn off my phone?
Ooh.
Turn off my phone?
Yes.
Earth to Matilda. This phone is as much a part of me
you
as...
You know what? Can we just cut it out with all these Earth twos,
We're not please? Actually saying this is the Earth calling, Matilda.
Yes, yes. No, I got that. I understand you don't literally mean...
No, I don't think you do. Listen... It's not that we actually think we're in a control tower trying to reach outer space aliens or something, okay? Hello? Hello? And scene. Wow.
That was good.
I can play dense. I think I pulled that off.
That was your best impression in a long time.
I don't know what that says. If you know what film we just massacred, email the movie's title along with your name and location to feedback.
Honestly, not since Tom Hanks at the end of Captain Phillips.
That's
have I
it.
Seen a guy go that deep?
Thank you. Thank you.
Something.
Where's
deep
my nomination?
Something.
He didn't get one. I didn't get one. Email the movie's title along with your name and location to feedback at filmspotting.net. Your deadline is Monday, February 10th.
Winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced on next week's show. To get official Massacre Theater rules, visit filmspotting.net.
Hoop Dreams is one of the five best pictures of the year. It deserves to be nominated as such.
I am 100% with you about this. You know, the category doesn't say best fiction film.
Mm-hmm.
It says best picture.
Right.
Hoop Dreams is a picture, and it is one of the best pictures of the year.
Sure it is.
The Roger Ebert talk continues as we get to our poll results. You just heard from the 1994 Memo to the Academy segment on Siskel and Ebert. Gene and Roger making their case for Hoop Dreams to be considered a best picture candidate, along with the likes of Forrest Gump, The Shawshank Redemption, and Pulp Fiction. Of course, famously or infamously, Hoop Dreams was not nominated for best picture, not nominated for best documentary, if I remember correctly. Wasn't that one
That's
of the real travesties of that year? Though for best picture, Four Weddings and a Funeral did get a nomination. That's kind of a low blow on my part, though, since I've never actually seen Four Weddings and a Funeral.
It's,
no,
it's good.
I'm sure. I love watching Hugh Grant stammer, but
no,
there's
really,
a little more than that.
He's really good
little?
At it. Even Annie McDowell couldn't sink that one. So.
Well, despite Hoop Dreams not getting a nomination for picture or documentary, it was one of the films that Ebert made a point of championing in his career. And so last week we asked you, which movie are you most thankful Roger Ebert championed? Your choices were Dark City, Eve's Bayou, Gates of Heaven from Errol Morris, Hoop Dreams, or Is it Synecdoche, New York?
That's right.
That's right? Okay,
yep.
Michael's weighing in already, Synecdoche, New York.
I got his vote.
Josh, you went Hoop Dreams. Yeah, and I went Eve's Bayou, not because I necessarily think it is the best film of the bunch, but that was, for me, the one where I really remember seeing that in Iowa and saying, I would never have seen that film or sought it out if it wasn't for Roger really pushing for it on the show. So that was my pick. Unfortunately, I'm definitely in the minority here.
Yeah, that's what it showed. 3% was the vote for Eve's Bayou, which came in last place. Gates of Heaven received 6% of the vote. And then a big jump here in the middle, 25% of the vote went to Synecdoche, New York. Dark City was in second place with 26% of the vote, and Hoop Dreams did win, 40%.
Maybe not a surprise there. We probably could have left Hoop Dreams out, called it the Hoop Dreams Memorial Poll Question or something, and saw how the other ones would fight it out. Definitely a tight race there, just a few votes separating Dark City and Synecdoche, New York. Kevin writes in, says, I think Synecdoche is the best of the films in this poll, but I'm most thankful that Ebert championed Hoop Dreams, because otherwise it might never have found an audience at all. At least Charlie Kaufman already had a minor cult following who could make sure his directorial debut didn't disappear into the ether. Steve James and Frederick Marx needed a champion in order to keep their spellbinding documentary from being lost in a spectacle-driven cinema environment.
We also heard from Zachary, who said, the obvious winner here has to be Hoop Dreams, but in best Academy Awards fashion, I'm going to vote strategically here to show Dark City some love, because Ebert's review of that movie was significant for my own development as a film critic. I remember thinking after I saw it, that was a very cool movie, but I was afraid to say that a sci-fi flick could qualify as great art, much less as one of the best films of the decade. Ebert didn't care about that sort of genre snobbery. If he liked a movie, he championed it, and he loved Dark City. And that gave me more courage in the future to call movies like I saw them too.
You know, I can't come up with one off the top of my head, but I bet all of us who grew up reading Roger or watching him on the show or just followed him religiously have an example of just that. Saw a movie and thought, am I supposed to love that movie that much? And then you read Roger's review and said, okay, it's okay.
It's okay.
Yeah.
No, that's one of the lasting things that I remember from reading his reviews, is just this. And it wasn't what we would call a desire to go against the grain. Mm-hmm. It was just a genuine, natural love, and he backed up his reasonings for it, too.
Mm-hmm. There you go. This is from Martin Cuevas in Brooklyn. Dark City is hands down my favorite sci-fi flick of all time. I remember seeing it in the theaters and rushing home to read Ebert's review. I was so thrilled that he loved it as much as I did, and blown away that he did an audio commentary on the subsequent DVD. Dark City continues to resonate with me as one of the smartest and scariest alien abduction movies ever. Whenever I do rewatch it, I think fondly of Roger and his love for cinema.
Trip Burton went in a different direction. Only one choice here, and that is Gates of Heaven. Maybe because it is far and away the best film on this list. Maybe because it was truly one of Ebert and Siskel's favorite films. Probably, though, because it is the only one of these that I got to see with Ebert, sitting in the balcony at Ebert Fest, Errol Morris in attendance, and Werner Herzog, who famously bet Morris to make the film, sneaking in the back of the theater halfway through. The laughter and emotion through the theater was electrifying throughout the film, but made so by knowing the profound love Roger Ebert had for that film and for sharing it with others. Anybody certainly who's been to Ebert Fest, and I know, Michael, you have on many occasions, you've had that experience too, like Trip had, where maybe you even went in knowing, I don't really like this movie a whole lot. And then something about seeing it on that screen and getting the perspective of Roger and the director or an actor associated with it and taking it in with that crowd, somehow it transforms the experience. I remember it did it for me with Ang Lee and watching the movie Hulk, which I thought was just horrible. Then I'm like, you know what? This Hulk's not bad.
Well, and I felt I never had a complete change of mind or heart down there, but the Richard Linklater film Bernie, which I liked, I just didn't realize that it would play like comedy gangbusters.
Oh, I can see
with
that.
A crowd
with
of
that audience.
Yeah,
they just eat it
really
up.
It changed the color of the experience completely.
Wow.
One more note here from Zachary Hay. He comes from Westland, Michigan. I voted for Synecdoche, New York because it is a beautiful, borderline masterpiece. In addition to that, we saw a performance in it from Philip Seymour Hoffman that was as dynamic and mesmerizing as the film itself. I swear I'm not just voting for it out of respect for the loss of this fine, fine actor. But if I can honor his memory in even the slightest way by voting for one of his best pictures, I will. Hoffman was as good an actor as you're ever going to find, and he will be dearly missed. And it's because of movies like Synecdoche, New York that I hold this view. Recognizing works of art as powerful as this is the reason Ebert is a legend.
Well said there, Zachary, and obviously a perfect transition into this week's poll question, as we are going to reflect on the life and the career of Philip Seymour Hoffman by asking you, what's your favorite Philip Seymour Hoffman supporting performance? Because he is one of those actors who really proved that old adage about there not being any small parts, just small actors. He was always larger than life when he was on screen, made the most out of any little bit of screen time he had. And I think we've given you here six options. Of course, there are many, many others to choose from, and you will get another option if you choose to go down that route. So, Josh, the options are...
We have Almost Famous, where he played Lester Bangs, or Boogie Nights, played Scotty there. In The Big Lebowski, he was Brandt. In Happiness, he was Alan. From Mission Impossible 3, he played the villain, Owen Davian. And then we have Punch Drunk Love, where he was Dean Trumbull, Mattress Man.
Mattress Man is fun to say. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it's the right answer, but it's fun to say.
We will give people the other option because you've got films like Talented Mr. Ripley, 25th Hour, Magnolia, Charlie Wilson's War, Moneyball. I mean, the guy just did so much good stuff.
Yeah, and Moneyball is one of those movies I like when it came out. I've since gone totally crazy for it and loved the movie. But if you say his performance as Art Howe is the best Philip Seymour Hoffman supporting performance, you're just wrong.
That's not where I would go.
No, you just can't go there, Michael. So back me up here. What's your answer to the poll?
Of those? I think
of those.
I'm going to go other and go with Talented Mr. Ripley because that is that's the Hoffman performance that for a lot of people made him realize he was really a force to be reckoned with. He had done a lot of work up by then already, but I think playing this sort of louche, Princeton, you know, moneyed mm-hmm. man, you know, this sort of sleazy guy of privilege whose only job in the story really is to kind of sniff out the lie behind Matt Damon's Ripley facade. I think Hoffman is probably the strongest element of that picture. I like that film, but Damon, in a funny way, wasn't quite ready to bring out all the facets of that part at that point in his career. He's actually he's a far better actor now, as most people would be 20, 25 films later. But Hoffman, that's the one where he was really ready to step up and, yes, steal scenes in that slightly aggressive, hammy way that any good character actor has. But I think right around the time of Mr. Ripley, Hoffman figured out a way to kind of invest in the character rather than just showboat. And he was the first to acknowledge that a lot of his earlier work to him years later seemed too much, too big. We talked about it in the interview I had with him about 10 years ago around the time of Capote. And I've always thought that the paradox with Capote, for which he won the Oscar, was that he was playing the most flamboyant, outre character he'd ever played, but it's actually his first truly subtle performance.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's fair. And Josh, I think we'll hold off until next week to answer this, as we are going to share our top five Philip Seymour Hoffman scenes. I think the first time I saw him on screen, not one of the options here, but I suppose you can lump it into other, was his performance in Twister. I think that's the first time I saw him. The first time I really became aware of him as a presence on screen was Scotty J in Boogie Nights.
Yeah, probably for me too. Magnolia, was that a few years later?
Yeah, a few years after that.
It would have been, yeah, the next film for Paul Thomas Anderson, right?
Well, let's hear from the object of Scotty J's affection, Mr. Dirk Diggler, Boogie Nights.
Wow. I don't know what to say. I guess the only thing I can say is I'll promise to keep rocking and rolling and making better films. You know, it seems you make these movies, and sometimes, you know, they're considered filthy or something by some people. But I don't think that's true. These movies we make, they can be better. They can help. They really can. I mean that. We can always do better. I'm going to keep trying if you guys keep trying. Let's keep rocking and rolling, man.
Mark Wahlberg as the former Eddie Adams. Please call him Dirk Diggler. That clip from Paul Thomas Anderson's Boogie Nights. And this week's top five, movies about fame. We are calling it the non-Hollywood edition. The porn industry, you could argue, not exactly Hollywood, despite Dirk's promise to keep making better movies. But for the sake of this list, we are excluding it. So Boogie Nights is out. There are a lot of movies that are out when you consider Hollywood is excluded. Some of those we'll list briefly. Mulholland Drive, Sunset Boulevard, Singing in the Rain, A Star is Born, What Price Hollywood. There are many, many others you could consider. I would even throw in there a movie like 8 1/2, not about Hollywood, but about filmmaking. It's one I kind of lumped into that group. So a lot of great movies, not in contention for this top five. And yet there were so many other great options to consider. And Where does this top five come from? Well, the concept of movies about fame really came from our plan review of The Great Beauty, the Oscar-nominated movie for Best Foreign Language Film. We are going to spend a few minutes on that in our bonus content, which you can get via the Film Spotting app. But of course, movies about fame also works with the film we talked about earlier, the Roger Ebert documentary Life Itself. Among other things, it is about Roger becoming the most famous film critic in the country. Mm-hmm. So that's our loose tie-in here for movies about fame. And Michael, I can't wait to hear your number five.
I can't wait to say it, you know. But I think my list, like yours maybe, it's sort of neatly divides between show business-related fame and other kinds of fame.
Mm-hmm.
So we're Hollywood's essentially off-limits here.
Right.
But, my number five would be Broadway, which is all about Eve. I mean, so this it's almost like a Hollywood fame-mongering festival of great acting and bitchy bon mots and all the rest of it. But Joseph Mankiewicz's really marvelous script, and you have incredible performances. Betty Davis, Ann Baxter as the gently undermining Eve Harrington, let alone George Sanders and Marilyn Monroe and so many other good people. That was a good year for fame-mongering, Adam, because you had one of the films off the list. We can't talk about Sunset Boulevard, same year. Those were the two biggest Oscar contenders that year.
Yeah.
And I think today, All About Eve has been famous for so long that in a way it's become one of those titles that some people I know say, well, you know, I know it's famous and I hear it's fun, but I just have never made time for it. Well, folks, make time for it. It's so maliciously witty in this portrait of what Eve Harrington, played by Baxter, will do to just kind of maneuver her way into the good graces of Broadway legends and then eventually join their ranks. It's just a great time.
It is definitely a great time, and I was one of those people. I really had never found the time to watch All About Eve until really the past 7 or 8 years. It was really since starting the show, it was coming up in so many responses to top five lists where people were saying, how can you leave off All About Eve? I really had to take it in and consider it. And it has made top five since then, just missed my list, but it had to come up. So Michael, I'm glad you did that for us. Josh, what's your number five?
For my number five, I'm going to go back to a marathon film. I think it was about a year ago, maybe a little bit more. It's from our Max Ophuls marathon, and it's Lola Montez. Mm. From 1955. It's his last film. It's his only color film. So maybe not exactly as representative of his work than some of the other stuff we saw, but still a really interesting, dazzling picture and one that's all about fame, essentially. It's based on a real life figure who was a courtesan in the mid-1800s, had a series of high-profile affairs with men across Europe, and really built a career on this. The film picks up and is kind of built around the end of her life where she's at this circus. Peter Ustinov is the ringmaster, and he brings her out as if she is just another tiger in a cage. And it's an odd setting because going around her are all these circus acts, and then everything slows down for her to be questioned by the crowd, and they want to know all about her notorious past, the details. She's not really given much of an opportunity to answer. Ustinov answers for her, which is an interesting touch. And the movie becomes this exploration of what fame meant, and not necessarily just back then. You raised your eyebrows, Adam, when I made the Kim Kardashian comparison in our initial review.
Yeah.
And it does seem a little strange on the surface, but it really came to mind as I was watching not only what this woman had pursued from what we see in her life, but where it had led and how it had come to define her, really. I mean, here's someone who had built a career out of this high-profile pursuit of acclaim or fame or certain pleasures, and she had become to be trapped by it in a way. It had become her life and become to define her. And part of the reason Lola Montez works as a tragedy is because we see, is there time enough left for her to escape that and become something more than this high-profile public image that's really trapped her?
Yeah, it's another one I really strongly considered. Maybe not our favorite Ophuls film for either of us from that marathon, but one that had to be considered for this list and really just a sumptuous movie to look at when you see what Ophuls does with the camera and also with the color. I think Kim Kardashian actually probably an appropriate segue into my number five. To quote the great Suzanne Stone Moretto, it's nice to live in a country where life, liberty, and all the rest of it still stand for something. Nicole Kidman playing Suzanne Stone Moretto from the 1995 Gus Van Sant film To Die For. It's a really juicy Nicole Kidman performance. She's just diabolically focused on fame, and she's a shallow person who does really horrible things, and I don't think we ever really sympathize with her, but you do recognize, I think Gus Van Sant at least makes room for us to recognize the desire she has to validate herself, to rise above her small town life, to be someone special. I think we can relate to that, but the way you go about it, at least in her mind and a lot of people's minds, and Kim Kardashian falls into this, is, of course, you get on TV. If you can get on TV, that's the answer to all of your problems. And there's that great quote in the movie as well from Ileana Douglas, who plays Lydia, Matt Dillon's sister, so her sister-in-law. And she says, Suzanne used to say that you're not really anybody in America unless you're on TV, because what's the point of doing anything worthwhile if there's nobody watching? So when people are watching, it makes you a better person. So if everybody was on TV all the time, everybody would be better people. But if everybody was on TV all the time, there wouldn't be anybody left to watch. And that's where I get confused, which really sums up the whole film in a lot of ways. And I read an interview today, actually, with Van Zandt, an old interview in the AV Club, where he told a funny story about the movie, that nonlinear structure it uses, where it kind of bounces around. You've got the direct address from Kidman, which was probably always in the script, but you've got that element, and they do bounce around in time a little bit. It turns out that came out of months and months of testing by the studio, which the studio was billing the movie as a romantic comedy starring Nicole Kidman. So it was just getting annihilated in all the cards that they get back, right?
I would guess so.
It didn't meet anybody's expectations. And they basically just kept coming back to Gus and his editor and saying, just fix it. We don't even really know what to do, but you got to fix it. This movie's going to be horrible.
Wow.
And they worked on it enough that they took the Buck Henry script, Buck Henry who wrote The Graduate, and they tried to sort of blow it up and start over. And even Gus says now that it made the movie better with that structure, which doesn't really have anything to do with fame, but I do think that is one of the strengths of the film, and it's just really ironic that it came out of something as crass and vulgar as studio testing.
Just business, baby.
Yeah, absolutely. Michael, you're number four.
My number four is Bennett Miller's Capote, and I'm not just saying that because of the Philip Seymour Hoffman discussion we're all having this week, but I think Dan Futterman's script, which focuses on Truman Capote's late 50s to mid 60s or so experience with writing, researching, writing, and then sort of dealing with the aftermath of the publication of In Cold Blood, is one of the great low-key but really devastating biographies I've seen in recent years. And it gets at something movies don't really care about or get right, God knows. And that's this complicated relationship between the chroniclers and the chronicled. You have Capote kind of becoming a different, compromised sort of player as he writes this story, this book, and then strikes and then maintains his friendship with one of the convicted killers.
What's the name of your book?
I don't know what you're talking about.
Truman Capote. Read last night before a packed audience from his nonfiction book, In Cold Blood. The true crime novel tells of killers Richard Hickok and Perry Smith, who brutally murdered a Kansas family 3 years ago.
Who sent that to you?
It's not your goddamn business.
It is my business because it's not true. The organizers of the reading needed a title. They picked one, a sensational one, I admit, to attract a crowd.
They picked it?
Yes.
It's not your title.
Harry, I haven't chosen one yet. How could I choose a title when we still haven't talked about that night? How could I? I couldn't. Possibly.
You pretend to be my friend.
I'm sorry.
The movie's extremely provocative, I think, in how it forces you to play it right down the middle with Capote and think, you know, he's a mixture of motives, some good, some not. He's, you know, a fame monger. He's a bit of a drunk. He's a lot of things. But when you kind of fly too close to the sun of fame, if that's really what you're seeking, and that's the movie suggests that certainly Capote knew what that was like, you really risk getting burned. And, you know, that's a sort of a simple moral, but the movie plays it out in a way that I think there's a reason Hoffman won the Oscar for it. And it's not just because it's a showy performance. I think it's a really, really meticulous and astute one. And the movie, I think Bennett Miller is a fantastic director.
Yeah, yeah, I'm with you. Josh, you're number four.
My number four is The Assassination of Jesse James by the coward Robert Ford, a movie that's ostensibly a Western, but probably better described as an art Western, just the sort of lazy style, not lazy style, but thoughtful style that it has. And then the picturesque framing and the pacing it takes. It does star Brad Pitt, though, as Jesse James. And people have talked a little bit about Pitt being a distraction in 12 Years a Slave just because of his star presence.
No, it's the bad performance, actually. It's not his presence.
I think it's the screenplay at that moment. But anyways, his celebrity is used in Jesse James purposefully. I mean, they're really making good use of it and incorporated it into the theme of what the movie is about. It does take place in the final days of James' life when his infamy it's spread so wide he's become this folk hero. He does have a price on his head at the time as well. I think Pitt is quite good here. I think he's squeezing out just the right amount of star power while still making room for hints of brutality and paranoia. I do think Casey Affleck is even better as the sniveling celebrity hound who's insinuating his way into James' gang.
I can't believe I woke up this morning wondering if my daddy would loan me his overcoat. And here it is just past midnight. I've already robbed a railroad train. I'm sitting in a rocking chair chatting with none other than Jesse James.
Yeah, it's a wonderful world.
Oh! What's this? Oh, yeah. Because I was real agitated this morning. I was wondering if I would know you or Frank, tell you all apart. And so I had this clipping that described you both. Want me to read it?
Go on.
This movie stood out to me, like I said, not only because it's not a traditional Western, thanks to the writer-director Andrew Dominik and the styling he brings to it. It also has that fairy tale score from Nick Cave and Warren Ellis. But ultimately, it registers for me largely because of Pitt's involvement as this moody meditation on the dark side of celebrity status.
Yeah, I've long had the excuse that I didn't have the experience so many people had, including you, with that film, because it was, for me, one of those Toronto Film Festival movies that you start the screening at 9:30 p.m. and it's the fifth movie of the day, and you just aren't in the right frame of mind for the type
that
of film
sort of film
you describe.
I love the film, and it's got a very languorous rhythm.
Yeah.
And
you got to give it its space.
I do, and I need to stop using that excuse. I finally need to revisit that film, and it simply has not only a talented director, but it has too many talented performers in it to not be a movie I appreciate more. My number four, I'm going back to 1967 and the documentary from D.A. Pennebaker, Don't Look Back, about Bob Dylan and his 1965 tour of England right before he ended up going electric and throwing the whole music scene, certainly the folk scene, on its ear. There are, of course, many great references in Todd Haynes's movie I'm Not There to this particular period in his life. Cate Blanchett playing Bob Dylan, probably my favorite section of that movie. But what you really see come through here is he is such a huge figure at that time that he goes over to England, and the expectations from the media, the types of questions they're asking him. There are so many famous scenes from Don't Look Back that really do play with that.
Do you think that a lot of the young people who buy your records understand a single word of what you're singing?
Sure.
Why do they do?
Sure.
Why do you say they do? How can you be so sure?
They're quite complicated songs, aren't they?
Yeah, but they understand them.
How do you know they understand them? Have they told you that they do?
They told me. Haven't you ever heard that song? She said so.
What you get as you watch this portrait is fame, essentially meaning that your every action is going to be scrutinized. If you're going to put yourself out there as some kind of poet or a thinker, whatever it is, every word is going to be scrutinized for its profundity or perceived lack of profundity. And Dylan is supremely aware of this, and it's heightened by the presence of D.A. Pennebaker. So you get this portrait of a performer always performing for the room, because everyone's expecting him to perform, whether it's literally playing music or just be on all the time. But he's also performing for the camera, because if you really look at it, Pennebaker goes to great lengths to always shoot scenes where the camera is really close to Dylan. And he'll shoot him in a car where it looks like he's 2 inches from his face, or they're in a back room down below the stage, and it's just Penny Baker and the camera and Bob Dylan. So as you watch it, you can't help but think about the fact that Dylan, no matter how he might be trying to ignore it, he's supremely aware of the camera. He has to be. So he's always thinking about the camera. And that dynamic of that performer and what's expected of you is something that Pennebaker, in a really sly way, does expose. And it's a movie that we watched a long time ago here on Film Spotting as part of our documentary films marathon. And it's one that I've revisited many times since and always gives me a lot of pleasure to watch Dylan like, you know, this enigmatic character that he was and just resist definition is really what he does throughout that entire film.
Like I always say, Adam, fame, bully for you, chili for me. Got to get a rain check on pain.
Bowie, I like it.
Thankfully, no rain check needed for the Film Spotting Top 5. It continues next. Stay with us.
Maybe every cloud has a silver lining. Maybe every dog really has his day. And it matters to me to see you smiling. Why don't we blow all your cares away? Yesterday is gone and will be forgotten. And today is where every new day starts. Got to be free as the leaves in autumn. You may be sad, but it never lasts. And maybe by the evening we'll be laughing. Just wait and see all the changes there'll be by the time it gets dark. We could go walking out in.
Donation time, that part of the show where we get to our donations and thank yous and some great listener comments here in a moment. But first, we do want to highlight our featured music this week, another Sam Van Halgren pick and one I wholly endorse, the New Mendicants from their new album Into the Lime. We heard their cover of Sandy Denny's By the Time It Gets Dark and the song Out of the Lime. The New Mendicants is a kind of indie rock supergroup. Joe Pernice from the Pernice Brothers and Scud Mountain Boys, Norman Blake from Teenage Fan Club, and drummer Mike Belitsky from the Pernice Brothers, and also Nico Case. The question, of course, is what is a mendicant?
It's a beggar.
Or mendicant.
Beggar, right?
Of course, you knew that.
Yeah.
A man as learned
it
as
wasn't
you, Josh.
Just no, on the sheet
Sam
in front
didn't
of me.
Write it there to make you sound as learned as you are. Let's get to our donations, starting with Lee in Elwood, Victoria, Australia, Omar in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, and Devin Wombold, a previous donor. He's in Sunnyside, New York.
Wait, so Sam is giving out nicknames again?
We'll see.
Sign me up. Also, you could probably milk another donation out of me if Maddie were to guess where in Queens I live, or perhaps give a fun fact about my hometown of Albuquerque, New Mexico. Or am I pushing my luck there?
You are.
Finally, for what it's worth, since I have a bad memory for this sort of thing, here are my top five film spotting discoveries from my recent, that is, Letterboxd memory. Before Sunrise, Sunset, Midnight, that's an Adam Kempinar cheat special, a trilogy, The Seventh Seal, Beasts of the Southern Wild, Grave of the Fireflies, Dogtooth, and a bonus SVU pick, Girl Walk All Day. Love the show. Keep up the good work, guys.
Thank you, Devin. And it turns out Sam did see your request. He granted you, he bestowed upon you a patented Sam Van Halgren nickname. It is Josh.
Jolly Jackboot.
Devin Jolly Jackboot. I don't know where he's going with it, but I like it. We also got this week, we don't have a whole lot of donations here, but we did get the, as this listener put it, the anticlimactic resolution of the Joseph from Raleigh cliffhanger.
Oh, yes, everyone's been dying.
Yes,
to hear
I know.
This.
It's like JR, who shot him, right? We had that email, the nice comments about the show, and then ... PayPal just cut it off. So he says, Joseph, that is, I don't know why PayPal chose to redact my contribution note, but I did get a chuckle out of your reading the ... on the air. So I get a second chance here to thank you for the great show. I especially enjoy the marathons and sacred cow discussions. It is ironic and kind of hilarious to remember how 20-year-old me would careen from strip mall trying to find a video store that carried some impossible-to-find Bergman movie. I love that that's part of Film Spotting's legacy, as we sent a 20-year-old Joseph greening around strip malls saying, where can I get my hands on some Bergman? Today I can stream the entire damn Criterion Collection on an iPad. Yet it's 10:30 at night and all I have the energy for is 20 minutes to watch Archer or something. But nothing stays the same forever, so thanks for helping me keep a running tally of films to see when the worm turns. In that spirit, here are my top five movies I wanted to see slash most anticipated movies of 2014 or 2015, depending on certain streaming and or pay TV rights. Wow, that's a mouthful. Inside Llewyn Davis, American Hustle, Nebraska, Her, and Before Midnight.
Pretty good list.
Yeah, for comparison's sake, here are the movies I actually saw in the theater this year. Gravity, Yay Date Night, Turkey Run, and God Help Me, Epic.
What is Turkey Run?
I don't remember Turkey Run. Let's look it up. Josh Vamp, while I look up Turkey Run.
It sounds like some sort of horrible animated family movie is my prediction. Let me know if I'm right there.
I'm not seeing anything for Turkey Run. I'm seeing Guide to Turkey Run State Park in Indiana.
So Joseph made Turkey Run up.
I think he made Turkey Run up. Is it the follow-up to Chicken Run?
Maybe that's what I'm thinking. Though Chicken Run's really good.
We do thank all of our monthly donors as well, whether it's $2, $5, or $10. And we had a great push recently to get more people to rate us on iTunes. It takes just a second. It goes a long way. It helps boost our ratings there, not only within the show, but in iTunes in general. In addition to our downloads, it does seem to kind of help push you onto the what's hot or up the rankings a little bit. We were pushing to get to 1,000 ratings. We're almost at 1,200 as we sit right now, Josh. So the new push is to 1,500. Let's get to 1,500 ratings on iTunes. Again, just takes a second. Go to iTunes, do a search for Film Spotting, and you don't even have to leave a comment. Just give us that 5-star rating if you do enjoy the show.
Light up your face, baby, let's get going. Want to see a change in those weary eyes. We'll have some fun.
This is Ryan Johnson, the writer and director of Brick, and you are listening to Film Spotting.
Up at dawning, sleepy and yawning, still the taste of wine. Then I remember you're mine, and I've got a world that's fine. What's before me? Routines that bore me, punch the clock at 8. But what a lucky guy I am. I've got a world that's great.
You're listening to Film Spotting. Adam, Josh, and Michael Phillips from the Chicago Tribune. The Film Spotting Top 5 this week, movies about fame. We've shared our 5 and 4 picks. That brings us to the top 3. And you're hearing Buddy Love, Jerry Lewis, of course, from The Nutty Professor. I've got a world that swings. Who else would pick Buddy Love for a top 5? Than Michael Phillips.
Absolutely. Jerry Lewis's career in its heyday in the early 60s, really, it was amazing how nakedly he explored this question of his own fame and this sort of this is narcissistic itch to just kind of deal in movies like The Patsy and an earlier one, The Bellboy, where he just suddenly turns up playing himself, surrounded, sort of bitching to his entourage. I mean, it's amazing. It's like psychodrama. And the greatest of them all is The Nutty Professor, where it's his masterpiece anyway, but where he plays, you know, Julius Kelp, mild-mannered, Bucktooth, the rest of it, and then you know, the guy he really wants to be, and then when he takes the potion, he is the swinging lounge lizard, who's partly based on Dean Martin, partly based on Frank Sinatra, and largely based on Jerry Lewis, Buddy Love, who's kind of this embodiment of a kind of greasy, alluring fame that nobody can resist, least of all Stella Stevens as Miss Purdy. It's a great self-portrait in egotistical fame mongering. And the fact that Lewis found a way to be honest and still be funny about it and come up with his best film, I'm in awe of it.
Jerry Lewis, a potential marathon topic here. Is that where you were going to go?
I was just going to suggest it, but then I realized we disappointed Michael so much with our Marx Brothers marathon.
There's no way we would properly appreciate
that risk again.
Well, here's the thing, too. Fully half of the stuff he did, really, I can't even find what the defenders are getting out of it. You know,
we'd have to choose wisely.
That was a tough decade. I mean, he started out right on top, and whatever one thinks of him, sort of on the top of his game. And, you know, 4 or 5 films later, he was already scrambling and repeating himself. And falling out of favor, and then he got more desperate, and interesting career. But if you really open it up to look at like the best of the Martin and Lewis stuff, you're talking about Frank Tashlin films, Artists and Models. You're talking about films that really are worth seeing. So yeah, it's a marathon topic. Let's go. Let's do it right now.
I love it.
Could you cue it up, please?
My number three, it's a music documentary like Adam's pick, Don't Look Back. Sort of a music documentary. A lot of playing around here. A Hard Day's Night, the Beatles film. It made my list for top five credit sequences in November of 2012, but it's really more appropriate for this list. It does open with that famous image of the band being chased down the street by that mob of screaming girls. You've got the excitement, but also the threat in that moment. And I think the director, Richard Lester, he makes the movie do two things at once most of the time. It's a document of Beatlemania, of course, and also this parody of it. The defining scene for me is that impromptu jam session they have on the train while they're traveling. They go back to the luggage area, and for some reason, there's like a cage section where the luggage is in. So the band is in the cage, and all of these adoring girls are outside clawing at them, and you have the effervescence of the performance and this ominous attacking motion as well. The movie really is one long chase sequence. It's like fame is nipping at our hero's heels. And I also like how it touches on the commodification of fame and how that was already in the works, had been happening way back then. There's a scene where George is being asked to endorse these clothes.
Now, you'll like these. You'll really dig them. They're fab and all the other pimply hyperboles.
I wouldn't be seen dead in them. The dead grotty.
Grotty?
Yeah, grotesque.
Make a note of that word and give it to Susan.
And I think we need to bring that word back for reviews, Adam. Call films grotty.
Wow. You lost me completely there.
Hard Day's Night is my number three.
Well, I definitely considered that as well. It's just been about 15 years since I've seen it, but certainly.
Oh, it's a great kind of holds up.
Yeah, great candidate for this list. My number three, Michael, we're simpatico here. I'm going with Jerry Lewis as well, but in the 1983 Martin Scorsese movie, The King of Comedy. Mm-hmm. And certainly he plays a character who is actually famous, but is the foil, if you will, on some level for Rupert Pupkin, played by Robert De Niro, the man who longs to be a man like Jerry Lewis's Jerry Langford. He wants so badly to be famous, he ends up in a plot to kidnap that TV star. And the film is basically just about Rupert's constant fantasy indulgence. We see sequence after sequence where he acts out this desire to be this man and to be the entertainer that he wants to be and really thinks he could be if he was just given the chance. And he thinks that Jerry Langford is the key to that.
There's got to be a way you can work it out. It's just 6 weeks.
Excuse me, Mr. Pupkin, do you think you could?
Yeah. Sure. What's your name, dear?
Dolores.
Dolores? Yeah. That was my father's name. To Dolores, who sensed greatness. There you go, sweetheart.
Thanks, Mr. Pupkin.
Don't mess up.
Rupert, who are you talking to?
Mom!
What is it?
Please stop calling me.
The great coda there to that particular fantasy sequence, reminiscent of Will Ferrell in Old School. Mom, please, telling her to shut up from the basement as he's living out this fantasy where he really thinks he's having lunch with Jerry Langford, and he can see himself as the type of man who Jerry really needs Rupert. He wants him to take over the show for 6 weeks, and fans are coming to him for autographs and interrupting their meals. You not only have Rupert and Jerry and the way he deals with fame, but the Sandra Bernhardt character plays a woman who is just obsessed with the Jerry Lewis character and is really stalking him, which I don't know if it really comes through so much that she has a desire to be a famous entertainer, but she clearly thinks that this is going to be somehow her key to her own type of fortune or her own way out to be someone special.
These characters, I'm sorry, they're just unhealthy. They should just sit down with that song, Make Someone Happy, which has the lyric, fame, if you win it, comes and goes in a minute. Where's the real stuff in life to cling to?
Wow.
I just want to tell those people.
I know. They all badly need it. And I mentioned the Jerry Lewis character here because even though he's the one who's famous, one of my favorite sequences in the film, and it came up once before when we did a top five a few years ago, dramatic performances by comedic actors. And this performance from Jerry Lewis was in my top five. There's a scene where he goes home from the studio, and I think he's just told Rupert to leave him alone, and he just wants to go home. And he goes in, and he just sits there, and he eats alone at his dinner table. And you realize that despite all his fame and his fortune, he might be actually as lonely as Rupert is. And despite the fact that Rupert wants to be that guy, he thinks that having the money and the fame and the respect is going to be the answer to everything. And of course, only a character like Jerry Lewis's character can really understand that it's not the answer right. to everything. It really comes through in that scene. So I love The King of Comedy, a film from Scorsese I saw ages ago and thought was sort of minor Scorsese and revisited in the past 5 or 6 years, and I love it. It's up there among my favorite Scorsese movies. So
that's great. Yeah, I'm due for a reviewing, too. It's been a few years. Yeah.
Brings us to our number two movie about fame. Michael.
My number two is another kind of fable of Broadway. It's Vincent Minnelli's 1953 musical, The Bandwagon, with Fred Astaire. And I like this for this category, guys, because Fred Astaire's playing a lightly fictionalized version of himself. And it sort of is fairly honest about Astaire's somewhat waning star by the early 50s. He had had a couple of box office disappointments, and he had been in the game a long time. I mean, he was, if you go back to his first film in 1933, he had a full 10 years on guys like Gene Kelly. And, you know, the musical cycle was waning at MGM, and but they had some great ones left in the studio mill, and this is definitely one of them. The Bandwagon finds this character, you know, this sort of slightly washed-up Hollywood star returning to Broadway to star in a musical that turns into this miserably pretentious Faust legend with tunes, and they realize it's all going to hell and going the wrong direction. They just have to kind of get back the old song and dance. And it's easily one of my two or three favorite movie musicals. And if you haven't seen The Bandwagon yet, see it. It's a delightful little subject of fame and its discontents.
Where would you put The Bandwagon if it's for you that high in terms of movie musicals? Yeah. Then obviously it's going to be a top or near the top of any Vincent Minnelli list as well.
Yep. I mean, Minnelli made Meet Me in St. Louis and Gigi, which I don't put as high. I love Meet Me in St. Louis, and I'm very, very fond of American Paris. The Bandwagon is not the kind of kinetic explosion that a film like Singing in the Rain is. It doesn't have that kind of punch, and it doesn't have that sort of choreography because it's for an older Astaire. It's not Eat 'em Alive choreography. It's a little lower key, but the duets with Sid Charisse are just terrific. And Michael Kidd from Broadway, who did the Guys and Dolls on Broadway and did, of course, Seven Brides for Seven Brothers a year later in film. You know, it's wonderful work. I love it. I love it.
For my number two, I'm going to go back to the marathon. Well, in the spring of 2012, we did contemporary Iranian cinema. And one of the pictures, the one I chose for my favorite out of that bunch, was Close Up, Abbas Kiarostami's 1990 experiment in film form, in narrative, film theory. Now, usually that's more your thing, Adam, but what really hooked me with the way Kiarostami played with it here is that it was all centered on one person, one specific personality, Hossein Sabzian, who actually plays himself in the film. In real life, Sabzian once posed as the famous Iranian director Mohsen Makhmalbaf, and he conned a wealthy family into believing that he was going to use their home as a set for his next film. That charade eventually did unravel, and the real-life Sabzian was taken to court. And so Close Up is this documentary-like restaging of those events, including the actual trial, and it uses a lot of the real people who were involved. As far as fame is concerned, it's less about the notoriety or the stature that a famous director has. I think those are the elements that a lot of the movies we've been talking about have dealt with. But here, it's really about how the trappings of fame, it's a tool for Sabzian. This is going to allow him to get closer to the actual art. And it was just a real revelation of how intense someone can feel about art, about a movie, and be attached to it. I think at one point Sabzian describes Makhmalbaf's films as a part of me. So he comes to identify the movies with himself. And if it takes adopting a famous person's persona to make that connection a little tighter, so be it.
Well, this worked out well, Josh. If we're going to have an overlap, you got to go first and do all the heavy lifting. Close Up from Kiarostami, my number two movie about fame. And I'll just add, looking back at my notes from the marathon, the key sequence for me in that movie that we spent a lot of time on was the one where Sabzian goes deeper into the psychology of why he did this. Because that's really what the film is all about, is what would possess you
right.
to take on this alter ego or pretend to be this man and take the con out as far as he does. And he talks about the respect it gives him from the family and how important you can see that being for a guy who is kind of hungry and doesn't really have a job and has no identity. So anybody else's identity.
He's an aimless figure.
Yeah, he is. So taking on a famous person's identity is better than trying to make up one out of the scraps of whatever he has. But also what really comes through is the way it gives him a purpose. It gives him control in life. He has no control, but just pretending to be a famous director imbues him with the power to say, I want that, do that. He can start pretending to truly be that guy and be the type of person he wants to be just by taking on that persona. It's a fascinating film, and it speaks to how great that marathon was and the films that we saw as part of that lineup. That movie, for me, as good as it was my second favorite film from the marathon, but there were just some really fantastic movies that we saw there. So that brings us to our number ones. Michael, your top choice for a movie about fame.
Oh, man, I adore Sweet Smell of Success from 1957 and the Clifford Odets dialogue. Other people worked on the script, but the Odets dialogue that he wrote for Burt Lancaster's venal, powerful, Walter Winchell-like gossip columnist, J.J. Hunsaker, and his sort of factotum gopher, sycophantic, weaselly associate, the publicist Sidney Falco, played by Tony Curtis. It's just some of the best, meanest verbiage ever heard in an American movie. And it's a twin dueling portraits of fame. Hunsaker's got it, and he's power, and he'll do anything to maintain it and just sort of flick off anybody who threatens it. And nobody's hungrier for it than this guy, Sidney Falco, who just hasn't had. And there's a wonderful speech early on where he just explains it. He says, way up, he's talking to his secretary, way up high where it's always balmy, that's where I want to be, where no one snaps his fingers and says, hey, shrimp, rack the balls, or hey, mouse, go out and buy me a pack of butts. I don't want tips from the kitty. And he goes on and on. And he says, in brief, from now on, the best of everything is good enough for me. And, you know, it just explains, okay, this is what I want. It's like the Broadway show tune tradition. There's something called the I Want song, which has to come in the first half hour to explain the protagonist's desires. What do they want? I want this, you know. And this is Sweet Smell of Success is like a series of those I Want songs where they're just, you know, the duel between to the death between Hunsaker and Falco. It's just great. I love it. It's this acrid, wonderful portrait of the high price of fame.
Don't remove the gangplank, Sidney. You may want to get back on board.
JJ, it's one thing to wear your door collar. When it turns into a noose, I'd rather have my freedom. The man in jail is always for freedom.
Except if you'll excuse me, JJ, I'm not in jail.
You're in jail, Sidney. You're a prisoner of your own fears, your own greed and ambition. You're in jail.
You're blind, Mr. Magoo. This is the crossroads for me. I won't get Kello. Not for a lifetime pass to the polo grounds. Not if you serve me Cleopatra on a plate.
Sidney, I told you.
JJ, I swear to you on my mother's life I wouldn't do that. Not if you gave me a column would I do a thing.
And who do you suppose writes the column while Susie and I are away for 3 months? The Man on the Moon?
It's such a good film and such a great performance from Lancaster.
I'm going to jump just a few years past 1957 to 1960 for my number one, La Dolce Vita. The clear inspiration for the movie we are going to discuss in bonus content, the great beauty in theme and setting. And fame, though, it's really just one of the things that fades in Federico Fellini's masterpiece. I did list it when we did our Sight and Sound show, listing our own top tens of all time. It made that list for me. So I really, really love this film. I mean, it does lament the fact that beauty, youth, and love are going to fade. And fame for this list, that's the one I do want to focus on. Marcello Mastroianni plays the celebrity journalist who's really scurrying around the heels of the rich and famous, and he's trying to just pick up whatever crumbs of fame he can from them. And one of his targets in the film is this Swedish actress played by the actual Swedish actress Anita Ekberg, and she takes that famous memorable dip in Rome's Trevi Fountain. The central irony here is that the Mastroianni character, even though he's just so desperate all the time, even though he's also kind of living this high life, and he doesn't seem to realize that these people he's chasing, that the fame and riches, that they haven't been able to make them happy. So how he thinks it's going to make him happy is a bit of a puzzle. And this movie is just – it's so incisive about the crazed culture also that – is created by fame. It's credited with creating the term paparazzi. That's the name of Marcello's photographer. The tag-along friend is named Paparazzo. So La Dolce Vita great movie for a host of reasons, and just one of them is what it says about fame.
Yeah, I'll admit, it was going to make my top five, but I just left it off. Call it my number six, because I knew it had to be yours, because it was on your all-time Sight and Sound top 10. Michael, I'll see your Burt Lancaster when it comes to venality, in terms of just corruption and low morals, and I'll give you Chuck Tatum, Kirk Douglas in Billy Wilder's Ace in the Hole.
Yeah.
I maybe can't go with Sunset Boulevard for this list because we're excluding Hollywood for these movies about fame, but I'm still going to sneak
Mexico.
On.
This is New Mexico.
No,
you're
exactly.
Fine.
New Mexico is fair game because he plays a reporter, Chuck Tatum, who is a big city newspaper guy, except he's been kicked out of every newspaper he's ever worked for because of his drinking and because of his just really poor ethics. And he breaks down in Albuquerque and ends up talking his way into a job at a newspaper there. And he's on assignment at one point. He learns about a man named Leo Minoso, and this is based on a true story, who is trapped in a cave while he was looking for ancient Indian artifacts. And what ends up happening through the course of the film is Tatum realizes this is his golden ticket, that he's going to not only do a story about this, but he's going to try to keep poor Leo stuck in that cave for as long as he possibly can and turn it into this human interest story that will interest every human in the United States and maybe beyond and be his ticket back to big time newspaper reporting. Great scenes, so many great scenes in this film. It's one of my all time favorite Billy Wilder movies. But when he talks to the sheriff and lays out for him the plan here.
How's this, Sheriff? Tomorrow I'll have your name all over the paper. The man who rushed here at the first cry for help to direct the rescue operation. By Tuesday, everyone in the state will know you. Gus Kretzer, the tireless public servant who never spares himself. I'll pile it on every day. 6 days of this, and I'll make you a hero. The election's in the bag. In the bag, the guys running against you will vote for you.
Okay, I'm a hero. Now what do I make you? Now, here's the deal. The way things look, there's going to be other newspaper men trying to horn in on this story. A lot of them. Maybe all the way from New York. This is my story. I want to keep it mine.
The way Kirk Douglas says to him, this is my story, you're going to keep it mine. And the way he just looks so possessed. He's so good at playing someone just full of self-righteous conviction. It really is all about him. It's not about this Leo person at all. And what you see throughout the whole movie is that everybody's trying to capitalize on this. It's not just Chuck Tatum. It is the sheriff. It's Leo's wife. It's even Herbie, the young reporter, the impressionable photographer who gets caught up in all of this and thinks, yeah, this is going to be my ticket to Life magazine or whatever it might be. So you not only see their drive to become rich and famous or at least gain more notoriety, but it's also really about the American appetite for celebrity. These people longing for some kind of distraction from the daily lives, that they actually venture out into the desert. They go to this cave, and the original title of the movie was The Big Carnival, mm-hmm. because that's what it becomes. It becomes a sideshow. Thousands and thousands of people just waiting outside the cave to see what happens. And it's a really bleak, cynical movie, which you get some of those elements in a lot of Billy Wilder films, but especially
that's a
here.
Load there. You know, yeah. It's part of a really kind of interesting trilogy and really kind of a key trilogy of 50s films. One of them is Sweet Smell of Success. And the other one we haven't mentioned is A Face in the Crowd, which also came out in 1957, where you're dealing with Ace in the Hole, Sweet Smell, and A Face in the Crowd. You have these vicious portraits of fame-mongering and the abuses of the American media.
Yeah.
And it's a cliche now, but just how the manipulators can manipulate by way of these new mass mediums and newspapers, mm-hmm. television, all the rest of it. And none of those films made a dime. They were big flops.
No, huge
all
flop.
Of them. But they just, the studios backed the writers and the directors, sometimes reluctantly, and just thought, well, we made money off them on this other one, and maybe the next one will be Some Like It Hot. Thank God, because all three of those films really get better every year.
Yeah. Douglas and his jaw, they deliver quite a performance in Ace in the Hole. It is my number one movie about fame, and those are our top five movies about fame. What about any honorable mentions, Michael? Any that you strongly considered but just couldn't fit on?
I mean, All That Jazz, I think, is a wonderful starting point for this topic. Bob Fosse's self-portrait. Forgiving, certainly. Fond, definitely. Here named Joe Gideon. Didn't cover up all of Fosse's flaws, but sort of cast him in a saleable leading man kind of way, as played by Roy Scheider. But it's a really a really brave, impressionistic, pretty trippy mainstream movie that did catch on with an audience and did get a lot of Oscar nominations. And I think it's pretty crafty about painting fame as a drug like any other drug. And it's one of the compulsions that Gideon uses to kind of fuel his next projects. And a lot of us, you know, to some small degree can relate to that. Whatever it takes to kind of move us into the next project or just sort of get the next review written or whatever. it's not about fame. It's more just about potential public humiliation.
Yeah.
and what you can do to avoid it.
Well, longtime listeners know All That Jazz is a film I absolutely adore, one I really would have strongly considered, but it's come up enough over the years that it's kind of in my personal penalty box, along with Almost Famous, which is another one with Philip Seymour Hoffman that does certainly fit with this category. What about you, Josh?
There were a lot of good suggestions made on Facebook and Twitter. One that came on Twitter was from Just Another Dude, and it's Millennium Actress, which I had forgotten about, but actually really liked, a 2003 Japanese animated film from Satoshi Kon. It's about the memories of an aging movie star. Also considered The Red Shoes, the Michael Powell and Emmerich Pressburger Technicolor extravaganza about a rising ballet star. The Wrestler, the Darren Aronofsky picture with Mickey Rourke. And The Truman Show as well. I gave some consideration to that.
Wow, The Truman Show. Completely forgot about
you
it.
You just saw it.
Yeah, a film I just revisited
time, right?
And loved it. I did not give that movie nearly enough credit the first time around. I really do enjoy that movie. A lot of the films that were on my honorable mention list have come up over the course of our picks here. I will say that along with The Red Shoes, and a movie really wasn't in the running, but a film like Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid is one you could say is about fame, or it's at least about famous people, and they're aware of that. But I don't know that it's really about them seeking fame or about them struggling with fame so much as some of the other movies we considered, so I left it off. I think The Red Shoes even counts as well. I don't see
I also don't
that
know
character.
If Butch Cassidy is even a very good movie.
Well, there you go. I have a soft spot for it, but I know that there are
more esteemed
critics like you, Michael, who
no, people
are harder
it.
On
people
it.
People adore it. It was, you know, people
yeah.
adore it.
But don't get Josh started on the B.J. Thomas sequence. He could talk all night about raindrops
now
falling
it's in
on
my
head.
Thank you. Thank you. Let's move on.
Other ones I did consider. Zelig, Woody Allen, The King of Kong, I think does probably fit that documentary about video game players opening night. Jenna Rollins, the John Cassavetes film.
Oh, yeah,
Nashville,
cool.
Robert Altman, and, you know, I really like Black Swan, the Darren Aronofsky movie. So.
This is good. No, I like that film. You don't like that film? No.
Outvoted, Josh. Sorry.
Too close to home for Josh.
Yeah, I guess so.
Brings me back to my ballet days.
Well, as we said, those are our top five movies about fame. We want to know what you think. Send us your picks or any other comments about the show to feedback@filmspotting.net.
You can also leave us a voicemail, 312-264-0744, or find us on Twitter @FilmSpotting and at facebook.com/FilmSpotting.
Out in limited release this weekend, opening in Chicago, 24 Exposures. It says here this is an erotic thriller from Chicago director Joe Swanberg. Could this actually be correct?
He has
made three movies in the past 10 minutes.
Yes.
Getting hard to keep track.
Yes. In fact, I'm going to see this film tomorrow. So,
are you?
You
report back to us?
A full report.
Okay.
Yes.
Can't wait. It's about a photographer who is suspected of murdering one of his models. Seven Boxes, an action thriller from Paraguay that played at the 2012 Toronto Film Festival, also opening. Everybody's Street, a documentary about the masters of New York City street photography, and A Fantastic Fear of Everything. This is Simon Pegg as a novelist whose research into the lives of Victorian serial killers makes him paranoid. Yes, that subject matter will do that to you. Out in wide release, The Lego Movie from writer-directors Phil Lord and Chris Miller, who gave us 21 Jump Street and Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs, with voices of basically all the funny people, including Elizabeth Banks, Chris Pratt, Will Arnett, Jonah Hill, Alison Brie, Will Ferrell, Channing Tatum, and many others. Michael, The Lego Movie. Seen it?
Loved it.
Loved it. See,
loved
I'm
it.
Hearing
yes,
that
I've
people
been
love it.
Really good things.
Loved it.
And my 12-year-old, soon-to-be 12-year-old Holden, told me the other day he really wants to see it. So I can take him enjoy it.
No, I stunningly good surprise.
Okay. Well, I'm going to go out on a limb and say maybe not a stunningly good surprise here. The Monuments Men, also opening in wide release from writer-director George Clooney. Josh, we're going to quote Josh here from Letterboxd, seems to think its job was done after casting was completed. Usually you betray nothing in your little one sentence first impressions, but I think you betrayed
that
a lot
a
there.
Clear. You know what's most frustrating about this is that you expressed no interest in this movie.
Zero.
And turned out to be right.
But it's a good subject. It's heartbreaking because it's a good subject. Oh, Richard Roper loved it.
Okay, well, the George Clooney character I discovered a few weeks ago when I was back home from Iowa. The Real Man from Iowa.
Doesn't really help the film.
That doesn't help the movie? Okay, fine.
Even that couldn't save.
No, which, you know, it saves so much. Next week, Philip Seymour Hoffman, we will be paying tribute to the late, great actor with our top five Philip Seymour Hoffman scenes. We may have a guest on as well to contribute, and I'm not going to catch up with Monuments Men, but obviously Josh has seen it, so he might sneak in a few more negative words about it.
No, I'm going to spend the next week trying to convince myself that I love it, just so I can go against you.
I love it.
Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Halgren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Thanks to associate producer Candace Griffiths, and special thanks to everyone at Chicago Public Media. Chicago Public Media creates award-winning content about the issues that affect our community, our nation, and our world. More information is available at chicagopublicmedia.org. Thank you, Michael, for joining us yet again. We want to read those reviews of Lego Movie Monuments Men. That's at chicagotribune.com/movies, right?
You know it, Josh.
I got
Adam,
it.
Adam, thanks. Thanks, guys.
It's always a pleasure. And of course, they can follow you on Twitter as well at
Phillips Tribune.
There you go.
Our featured music was from the New Mendicants. It comes from their new album, Into the Lime, and more information is available at thenewmendicants.com. For Film Spotting, I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.